I'm Adam Rappaport, and this is the Bon Appetit Foodcast. This week, we've got Nancy Singleton Hachisu here. She is the author of the James Beard Award-nominated books, Japanese Farm Food and Preserving the Japanese Way. Nancy grew up in California, traveled to Japan for a stint abroad, and, well, while there, she met a Japanese farmer, fell in love, and 30 years later, she's still there. Her most recent book is Japan the Cookbook, a gorgeous, comprehensive book that came out last month. And associate editor Christina Che sat down with Nancy to talk about this latest work, a massive volume that includes over 400 recipes. All right, so let's do this. Here is Christina and Nancy.
I don't know how often you get a chance to actually come back here to the States, but do you have a particular restaurant or a food that, you know, when you come back, you're just like, I have to get this because I can only get it here?
You know, it's the food I would want is something that I'd have to buy, like sausages, sausage or salumi, but I actually don't really buy salumi anymore. Pretty much that's the only thing that I could. Oh, oysters. Mm. Really good oysters. Mm. Crab. And so those are not oysters or restaurant crab, typically home or restaurant. So it just depends. But restaurant wise, I look for something fairly simple but delicious. Like I am a big fan of Renard's, and I, of course, love Chez Panisse.
I would imagine oysters, and I'm surprised. I would imagine that oysters and crabs are actually
Not good.
They're, no.
If you, oysters, in Japan, the history of eating oysters was the oysters were harvested and they were shucked and sold already shucked, mm-hmm. which is one reason why the Kumamoto's went by the wayside, because the Hiroshima oysters and Miyagi oysters are like probably 4, 5, 6 times as big as the Kumamoto's. And so it took a lot more to shuck Kumamoto's to fill up a box than Hiroshima, but they're bringing those back. And then crab, you cannot find live crab. And Dungeness crab is one of the greatest crabs in the world, I think. And so, you know, when I go to California, I eat crab when I can.
It's so funny. I mean, there's a part of my brain that really, when I think about crab and I think about the way that I experienced a lot of sort of very westernized Japanese food, it's like all I can think of is the fake crab, red and white sticks.
That's
and I'm like,
horrible.
You know, is this, what is this?
Right. It's, what is it made from, a cod or something? Yeah.
You know, I've always been too scared to read the back of that package.
don't bother. Yeah.
So your book, which is gorgeous, and I have in front of me, this is your third cookbook, yes.
Right.
Published by Fiden, came out at the beginning of April.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that obviously I feel like we have to talk about is, you know, the fact that this is a cookbook that represents the breadth of an entire country's cooking, whereas your previous two books were more sort of niche topics. You know, you focused on farm food mm-hmm. in one and focused on preserved foods in one. And, you know, I guess I'm just sort of wondering what the biggest difference is in thinking about how to approach a cookbook that addresses a scope that's just so much bigger.
Right. Well, all cookbook projects, or probably all projects, they take shape organically. You start with this framework idea and you work towards what your idea of the framework should be. But along the way, as the material comes in or as it sort of gels, then it takes shape. And here with this book, I knew it was a huge project. And my other publisher was Andrews McMeel. It was my first time with Fiden. And I was a little bit scared. I didn't want to miss deadlines. I was 6 months late with a preserving book. So this was not going to happen with Fiden. So I started working immediately before, we had had the agreement, an oral agreement for the contract. Before I even had the contracts, I started because I knew I could not waste any time. And I split up the country in areas where I knew a chef that I had connected with. And even if his food was not going to end up in the book, he would be the conduit for me to get further into that local area. And most of those local areas, I already had artisanal contacts, food artisans. So that was how I first approached it. And I started traveling. Over the course of the project, it took a shift because all of the material that I gathered and photographed while traveling, it shifted off because of, you know, there's the publisher's ideas and my ideas, and we weren't meshing there. And so the photographs material was set aside, and now it's going to be a different book. And then it became, along the way, I found this body of material, these 70s, 80s body of material that became the book. And so, yes, it's a compendium of Japanese food, but can you really say that these 400 recipes are all of the food in Japan? Is the food today the same as that? And do you want to write about the food today?
Sure. I mean, and I think that was also something that really struck me that I didn't know about this book before I started reading it, was that it really is, it captures a very particular moment in the history of Japanese cooking. And, you know, I think the way that you described in the book is sort of this relative area, this relative time period of prosperity in mm-hmm. the 70s and 80s, where you're kind of a few decades away from the post-war era.
Right.
And, you know, I just, as someone who, you know, truly knows very little about what was going on sort of in the way that people were starting to cook at home in this more luxurious way, you know, I just thought that was really interesting. And I was hoping that you could talk more about what defined the cooking of that time and what felt right about it for now.
It's something that I came at. I mean, I'm not the expert or historical expert, and it's something that I came to intuitively. I arrived in 88, and already the food was changing. Like, it was a normal thing to, when you invited somebody to your house, you might have a few homemade things, but you would definitely get some sort of delivery thing. And, you know, one of the first meals I had at somebody's house had homemade chirashi sushi on the table and then Kentucky Fried Chicken, you know, which I avoided. But I just, through the eyes of these cooks and through this material, and this is mainly through two women, it was Japanese out-of-print books, and I knew both women, one fairly well, and the other one I had met her several times and had attended food confabs with where she was the main cook, and she was like she must be 88 now, very powerful, tall but gentle woman, and she was a very legendary cooking teacher in the north of Japan. And I did record her on the iPad and the iPhone, and I video and recording, sound recordings and notes and photos. But then I discovered that of the two Japanese language cookbooks that I really loved, and that my son, who works for me, who's got a great palate, he also loved. We shared, we both zeroed in on, independently on these two books, that was our two favorite books. And so they became the unifying force for the whole book. And then I just went and picked up from other books that I had previously looked at. These were written in English, some by gaijins, the foreigners, non-Japanese, and some by Japanese ladies. And again, it was all sort of out of print books that I had collected over the years. And I thought they were just a little bit dated, and I didn't ever use any of the ideas in my other two books. But I went back to them with these eyes. And sometimes you can, if you look at it differently, then, wow, this is kind of dated. And I see they put some a little strange substitutions in, but I can fix this. And so, and it's actually, it's, you know, you cannot find good recipes in Japanese on the internet. You get Cookpad or out of print books. Those are your options.
And use Cookpad?
It's like Yelp or recipes. It's everybody contributes. And so you can Google, Google this one classic recipe, like even Nikujaga, right? And so easy peasy Japanese recipe. And you'll get up all these bizarro variations, and they have nothing appealing about them for me. So I'm looking for something really classically classic.
And is that just because there isn't really a focus on a particular type of cookbook, you know, that is being published in Japan in Japanese and, you know, is for that audience?
Yeah, you know, cookbooks in Japan, they're almost like magazines.
Mm.
They're thin paperback by and large, not, and they're very few books like this, like we have in America, these thick pictorial books.
So would that just be an unusual thing to find in someone's home? You know, bound books like this one?
That would be like a very well-known chef book. It would be coffee table slash, I mean, it's just not a thing so much. You wouldn't really find it in people's houses.
Is there any kind of like seminal cookbook, I guess for lack of a better word, that you might find in many homes that, you know, is sort of treated like a Bible of sorts?
Not that I've ever come across. You know, there's space issue. You know, it's just like everybody lives in a small apartment in New York, but there it's in Japan, you know. So it's a space issue for food, for cooking equipment, books. It's a magazine culture and a small book culture. You know, most of the reading books, like all of my husband's or son's books, they're smaller than our paperbacks and they're thinner. And we've got, I feel like there are millions. They're like a fungus all over the house. But of course, I love books. They're for me, they're like decorations, stacks of Japanese books all over, along with my stacks of cookbooks. So.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, you know, I live in a small New York apartment, and somehow there's always there's always room somewhere.
Right,
it's like
right,
in the
right.
closet or, you know, on the floor, you know.
Stairway.
Yes, on the book on the windowsill, you know,
right.
Books are just spilling out of everywhere.
Right, right, right.
And
but they're pretty.
They're pretty,
yeah.
And they're not a problem
no.
yet. The way that you describe the book in the introduction is, I feel that you really emphasize that this is not really an examination of the various regional cooking traditions within the country. And I think, I thought that was sort of interesting, and I wasn't sure if, you know, the fact that there is less regionality than you might expect is just a product of the larger effect of globalization, or if it is just, you know, a different, you know, it's just a different way of cooking and of exchanging information about cooking.
Yeah, I mean, originally, like I said, I was separating the country in basic regions, and at that time I realized more and more, and I struggled with what to do with Okinawa or Hokkaido, and you know, and I had travel in Japan is expensive, and this is something the authors pay. And so I had to make decisions, and I had to concentrate on the main island and then Kyushu.
Mm-hmm.
And I also didn't want anybody to feel slighted, I mean, any area.
Right.
And so, and there's a lot of similarities. You know, everybody's making kimbira, like the sautéed.
Just one of my favorite things.
Yes, soy sauce sautéed, stir-fried, you know, burdock or carrot or whatever, actually. And there's, you know, there is a variation in households. There's variations in some regions, certainly, but it's not as, and there's regional dishes, but mainly biggest differences in the regions that you can see, boom, right off the bat, is in the mountain vegetables. And everybody kept saying, you got to come back in the spring in the mountain vegetables, which we don't have in America or in the EU.
I was going to say, when you say mountain vegetables, like, you know, what sorts of...
Well, you know, it's like seri, the wild parsley, or udo. It's like a kind of, it's a stem thing, and fuki, and...
basically nothing you would be able to find in the most well-stocked farmer's
it's
market.
It's a bitter, they're bitter. There's so many of them. And again, it's regionally oriented. And I've discovered ones that I had not known about on my travels. But the only one that we really have would be fiddlehead ferns, you know. And so I didn't want to keep putting in all these, focus on a whole subset of foods that was not available.
Right. You know? Right.
So anyway, it went along, and I've just felt like separating the book by type of cooking, the classic cooking method, was going to be better. And then actually, the material sort of became. I was gathering it in a non-regional fashion, and so it covered many regions, but, and there's definitely local foods, but, you know, not all, we call it Kyoto ryori. Kyoto ryori is regional foods, and not all Kyoto ryori is delicious.
Mm.
Like, a lot of it is not so appealing, frankly. So this is really delicious, bright, lots of knife work, actually. It takes some time for the prep. Really pretty food, clear flavors, some shojin, so temple food influences, but definitely not, you know, it's not a vegetarian book or a, but it's got a lot of vegetarian friendly recipes. You can just take out the fish or take out the meat,
mm-hmm.
Which is how I like to eat. I mean, I do like meat and fish, but I'm kind of a fanatic for vegetables.
Sort of meat and fish as the accessories.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. But that's, I mean, the history of Japan is you know, vegetarian,
mm-hmm.
and dairy, I mean, actually vegan.
It's funny. I mean, I can just, in flipping through some of the recipes, and you mentioned the knife work, that was kind of all I could think about in
yeah.
certain photographs where, I mean, you know, I have worked as a restaurant cook before,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, I think you learn certain things in that experience about how certain vegetables are cut and how long a certain julienne or
lots of julienne
an oblique
in this one.
takes. And yeah, and I was just like, this is all matchstick carrots,
right.
you know, and I was just like, you know, I mean, it would be slow enough
it's
process
really
for
slow.
Me.
It is slow.
And,
yeah.
you know, I used to have to do piles and piles of them.
Right, right, right.
But I mean, I do think it is one of, to me, that's always seemed to be one of the most interesting hallmarks of Japanese cooking is this, the way they distinguish between different knife cuts and the way
mm-hmm.
those knife cuts truly do seem to affect the entire composition
right.
or almost the flavor
mm-hmm.
of these vegetables in a dish has always been like so amazing to me.
Right. And I'm, you know, I'm not going to say I'm the best, you know, knife work person, knife cutter, whatever. One of the things when I've done a lot of collaboration dinners and the getting in the weeds situation is because of the under estimation of how long the knife work will take. So the veg prep is, but it's very centering, you know. I mean, when cutting julienne carrots when you're really in a hurry is a little bit frantic.
Do you use a mandolin?
Never.
Never?
Ever, ever, ever. I hate that.
Fascinating.
Idea.
It's, I
want the human element.
I feel like the Ben Reiner green or the white mandolins, you know, it's, they're becoming, you know, they're just kind of becoming a huge thing right now, I think, in a lot of home kitchens here.
Right.
And, you know, certainly we have been huge proponents of them.
Yeah.
You know, we're, all of the test kitchen editors, you know, have one, and I have one at home that I use all the time, and there are certain things that I can't imagine.
It's a soulless cut. I'm sorry. I mean, you know, I kept reading in Gourmet. They talked about the Ben Reiner for years, and then on all your magazines, you know. And I was like, what is this thing? And I finally, when I was writing Preserving Book, I went out and bought one. And then I was for making the dried daikon,
uh-huh.
and I cut the tip of my finger off, and I was like, because I was super busy, and I was like, arr. But no, I don't like the cut.
Do you think most other Japanese homes are not employing mandolin? Or
I'm sure they happily are. But in our house, we never had one. We were a farm kitchen, and my husband's a master with a knife, and so he was doing all the Japanese food, and then I was doing all the rest, but... now it's a little bit of a rivalry in the kitchen. I mean, I do like my food better. He likes his food better.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
One thing that I really wanted to talk to you in particular about, and this is something that I find I often have conversations with friends about, you know, at home and such, but it's basically this idea of this ongoing Western almost obsession or reverence for these traditional Japanese culinary traditions. And to me, I think as someone who works in the food media and is part of a, you know, a machine that is coming up with recipes that, you know, are pushing trends forth, or however you want to phrase it, you know, it does feel like increasingly there are certain Japanese ingredients like miso or mirin or dashi or, you know, what have you, that just feel like they're becoming much more ubiquitous in lots of different recipes than they've ever been, certainly in the time that I have been alive. And there are recipes that we will publish, you know, I'm thinking about one that we ran a few months ago, and it was for a miso cilantro pesto is what we called it. And, you know,
I remember that one. I do notice them. I don't read a lot of emails, but I always sort of check the headline, you know.
It was, I mean, it was incredibly delicious. It was just blended spinach and cilantro and some miso. And
what kind of miso?
It was white miso, I believe. that face. And everything just gets blended together and tossed with some cooked noodles and a little bit of butter. And the faces that you're making at me right now are so amazing. But yeah, I guess, you know, it's just how do you feel about all of this?
Well, well, if you read the historical chapter, what drove that in some way was my feeling that a lot of these ingredients are being used without truly understanding them. And just like Japanese use Western ingredients that they don't really understand.
They and, do seem to love ketchup.
Oh, yeah. And mayonnaise.
And
right. And so I know there's this huge love affair, and I know a lot of people are coming over to Japan physically, you know, visiting and gathering your materials, and I see it on the menus. I mean, I don't really eat out too much of my I've got my places, but I was involved in a Japan brand project, and I was coming with our local soy sauce and miso people and vinegar and sesame, and tried to go to a few restaurants that were using Japanese ingredients, and some were doing it better than others. And my biggest recommendation, and something I'll pass along to you guys too, is get the best. And just because maybe your readers or maybe this restaurant can't actually source those themselves, they don't want to spend the money, or it's not economically feasible in the restaurant, but learn from the best. Also, there's people who are involved in fermentation, or like the miso people. I was traveling with the daughter of the family, and she's the president of the sales, and she's, when I asked her about white miso, and she looked at me, she goes, I hate that. I never use that. It has no flavor. And actually, I never used it ever until I was testing for this book. I wanted to be true to the Kansai, that area's food, and so I did test using white miso, but it was...
But you're not happy about it.
Oh, it's, you know, if you use inaka miso, which is a fermented miso with white rice koji, no, it's not as sweet as the white miso, but the white miso has, like, I mean, minimal fermentation. You almost can't, so it doesn't have the properties of miso. It doesn't have the good properties of miso, or enough of them, in my mind. It doesn't have the, I hate the word umami, but doesn't have that either. And so I think that you can round out that Inaka miso, which is perhaps a little bit harder to find here, with a beautiful mirin, and then you're not going to achieve the same thing. But also, I use, you know, farm vegetables, whether it's our farm or my friend's farm. And so those are really powerful tasting ingredients, and they need to be flavored with powerful tasting flavorings, so they fuse together.
Right. I mean, that's interesting to think about too. I'm sure, you know, you take like an ordinary, like a supermarket carrot.
Yeah.
And
then that the supermarket carrot likes white miso. Absolutely. Give it to him. And also, just to speak about, I'll circle back to dashi. You know, we use hongare dashi, hongare katsuobushi. So it's skipjack tuna that's not just been simmered and smoked, but it's also been fermented and sun-dried for 6 months. And everything in the package here is just been simmered and smoked. So it doesn't mean it's bad at all. But and we used to use it when we stopped shaving, and then I didn't even know. My husband was buying the packs, and I didn't know it was not the real deal, or the all the way to the fermented and sun-dried. And then when I met the katsuobushi guy and I heard that, we went back.
There must be kind of a balancing element, too. I mean, if you're using, let's say, the fermented and sun-dried version of a katsuobushi, and you're using, you know, a relatively, like a relatively low quality or more diluted version of, let's say, like, I don't know, soy sauce or a mirin or something, like, it does seem like that might result in a totally different flavor.
Maybe not totally different, but dialed back in some way. And so, I mean, I mentioned this in the book, and it might not, you know, it's in one small place, but I do recommend, you know, finding your level and sticking with that level. And there's nothing wrong with that. Not everybody can, you know, pour all their resources and go broke on the food. But you're going to want to pair the more full-flavored artisanal products with each other, and then the mid-range with each other. And then if you're, you know, if the lower range is what you can afford, in most Japanese, that's what they use, you know. Mizukan vinegar, kikkoman soy sauce, ajinomoto, maybe aji mirin.
The aji mirin is what I have at home.
Oh my God. I'm throwing this at you now. It's not even mirin. Oh my God.
Oh, what can I say? It's what we had in my house growing up. It's the only thing I've ever known.
I know. It's not mirin. It's not mirin.
I don't know that you're going to love this question, but, you know, is there one sort of key core ingredient where if you had to really encourage someone to spend the money, get the best version of this one product, whether you're talking about miso or sesame oil or soy sauce, you know, is there one where it feels like if you're really going to spend your money on this one thing, it should be this?
It's soy sauce, actually. And I talk about it in Japan because, you know, most people use kikkoman. My brother-in-law works for them, but they do a good job. Yeah, but it will change your life. And this happened with me with olive oil. And so I related this to the use of soy sauce to people. I only ever used our local soy sauce because that's what my husband was using. If you take a bottle of soy sauce, beautiful artisanal soy sauce that's been, it's organic Japanese beans and it's been fermented for a year and a half in cedar barrels. And then you put it on, you know, ohisashi is the just boiled greens in the farm kitchen, boiled greens with just soy sauce, boiled refreshed greens, soy sauce, and then some katsuobushi. That's a, we don't even necessarily put dashi in it. The classic dish is dashi flavor with soy sauce, maybe a little mirin, and then hit with katsuobushi. All right. So if you put the soy sauce on the supermarket komatsuna or spinach or something, some sort of greens, the soy sauce is going to be, whoa, it's so delicious, and the greens are going to be zero, you know, and they just will not match. So then you're going to think, oh, I want to have some delicious greens. And so you put the farmer greens, small farmer greens with the delicious soy sauce. It's so perfect. And then you hit it with that crappy katsuobushi. And oh, that is so depressing. So then you're going to want to get the really good katsuobushi.
It's just never ending.
Like, see, so it's you have to. Nobody can just jump into this. And I didn't jump into this. It was years in the making. And I still, like for the preserving book, or even after that, I discovered more, you know, like a different vinegar maker. The Iojozo was during the preserving book. There's a life-changing sesame that everybody needs to know about, Wadaman sesame. The guys at
and you mentioned that in your book.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's we were at Serious Eats yesterday, and they're like drinking it. It was so good. White, black,
where
gold.
Where is ours?
I know.
Did they drink it all?
It's in my hotel room.
I have a word with them.
But really life-changing. Seriously. The sesame that you can find is poor quality, cracked, discolored, and probably rancid. Sesame oil, I mean, it's just so horrible. You might as well just dump it down the toilet.
And what should it taste like?
It should taste like beautiful sesame. Just again, think about something that's in your realm of thinking. So remember those big, huge cans or really cheap olive oils at the supermarket, right? And then you got the artisanal olive oil. Mm-hmm. It's like you can put an ice cream. You can take it. You can take tasters in the cup, right? That's the difference. I mean, it's black sesame has this sort of round and butteriness, or not butteriness, what was it? The gold is really toasty, but not it's warm, and the white is really clean.
And Wadaman sesame, so that's based in Osaka.
Osaka, yeah. It's a fifth generation company, and I met the guy at Fancy Food a few years ago, and the white sesame oil just like blew me away. But I thought, I don't need these fancy sesame seeds. We have local organic seeds, because the seeds, you know, there's no more commercial sesame in Japan because it's been outsourced to China. So he has a very small organic sesame production. He's a roastery.
Mm-hmm.
And then he has contract farmers in three countries. There's, and I can't remember always which country has which seed. And then he brings them in. He has organic. Each farmer grows organically or conventionally. He brings them in those big, huge bags. And then in Osaka, they clean them and roast them. And we can understand about coffee, right? So the roaster, I mean, the beans or the seeds come alive through the expertise of the roaster, right? And so then he also has a selection process similar to the almond people where they bing out the bad almonds with a laser air.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but that sounds so fun.
So he does it with sesame seeds. Can you imagine the monster almond compared to sesame seeds? That was what just sealed the deal for me. They're like, he's my best friend now.
Is this something that I can find here?
Yeah, Japanese Pantry in San Francisco and online. Yes, it's expensive. I mean, let's face it.
What are we talking?
You know, I really can't remember, but I think a bottle like this, which is, 300 mil or so, might be 20, 25, I don't know.
You know, but the funny thing is, you know, people will pay the money for good olive oil now, and I think you're completely right.
It's life-changing.
It's been this incredible shift to watch, you know, even in me, too. I mean, I grew up with totally crappy olive oil. Like, I don't actually know what was in there, sort of like the crab meat.
Yeah, me too.
And now I feel like when I go to the grocery store, like, I won't even blink an eye at a $20, $25 price tag. But I do think that at least what I find I get in return as a home cook is you don't really have to use a whole lot of it to achieve what you're going for.
Exactly. Exactly.
So almost feels like there's an economy that comes with the higher quality product.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I gave some to Daniel Ritzer. He said he had his sesame oil open for like 6 months and it never lost lost its, it never went bad. I mean, it's got a real power of its own. I mean, you want to use it faster, but you're afraid to because it's so beautiful. Right. You don't want to use too much, but now it's available. So yeah, I mean, all of those ingredients, soy sauce and mirin and the vinegar, you know, you use less because it has more flavor.
Oh, I feel so mortified. All I can think about right now is my
kitchen.
Pantry at home where I have an open bottle of toasted sesame oil just that's been sitting in my pantry for probably 6 months. And, you know, now I'm deeply embarrassed. And frankly, like I don't even know that I could necessarily tell you whether it's rancid or not.
It's, you know, yeah, because it's so strong. I mean, I actually hated sesame oil. And then I started buying organic, but it was Osawa, and they were good quality, and it was better, but I would thin it with some organic rapeseed oil, mm-hmm. Canola oil. And then, but this is just totally different. And you want to use it. It's like the difference when I started using Mikawa mirin, which you can get through Mitoku.
What is Mitoku?
Mitoku is the two big organic companies in Japan are Mitoku and Muso, Muso/Osawa. They've brought over all the artisanal Japanese ingredients in the 70s, but they repackaged. Mm-hmm. And Eden also does a good job at it. I think Eden is Ajinohaha, but it's a little bit thinner variety. But anyway, you can get it on Amazon. Mikawa mirin, best in the world. That you can get that's not really super, super special, small place, but it changed the way I cooked. Like, I want to use mirin now. I love it.
And, you know, actually, I feel like mirin is one of those ingredients that I feel like, you know, people are sort of like, I'm not exactly sure mm-hmm. how to use this or mm-hmm. where to use this, at what point in the cooking process I use this. There are definitely times when I'm just like, I don't know.
But see, that's where Mikawa mirin taught me. We didn't have it in our kitchen. We used sake and occasionally some mirin. So we did have it, but we just didn't use it very much. That was my husband's way, and he actually does use it more. But when I started using Mikawa, I had various mirins. I would buy them for, you know, just testing or whatever. And I had the understanding, I developed the understanding that mirin's function is to soften the salt in miso and soy sauce. And it's there to soften the sourness of vinegar.
And because it is on its own, it is a fairly sweet product, correct?
Naturally sweet, yeah, from the fermentation. It's the similar process to sake making, and don't quote me on this, but better mirins have glutinous rice. And rice, and that helps the saccharin getting to be sugarized. That understanding of the relationship is what I brought to that book, this book, Japan.
Okay, so speaking of the book, I just have a couple of questions left. One is, you know, do you have a few approachable or sort of beginner-friendly recipes that are in the book that might be, you know, that might be a good starting place for cooks at home who are just starting to get their toes wet with this style of cooking?
There are a lot of very simple recipes in this book. Yes, there are some that have multiple ingredients. And so if your time is limited, pick recipes that have less ingredients. And a couple, but what I would like to say is, what are some surprise ones for me? I didn't used to like dried shiitake, because dried shiitake was often, you know, like simmered up and really like, I don't know, it was too something. But I started buying these donko shiitake, or thick capped ones, and I bought better shiitake, and that's another thing that you trying to source, like Japanese shiitake, and mm-hmm. or perhaps you have some local ones here, I don't know. Anyway, there's a recipe for cucumbers and shiitake. It's called cucumbers and shiitake, I think, in sesame vinegar. And so it's got a lot of the watermelon sesame and gorgeous cucumbers and some really delicious vinegar, mirin, I think, and should have mirin, of course. And then it has dried shiitake that have been flavored with, I think, soy sauce and meaning. I don't have the book memorized, by the way. And then there's a sweet potato dish, which does use chicken stock. And it's sweet potato and that's been simmered in chicken stock with dried shiitake and some of that chatsai. You know, the chatsai is that the mustard stem pickle. It looks like this really oversized brain or something. It's Chinese. And it's one of those Chinese ingredients that jumps into Japanese food sometimes.
Like a pickled mustard green.
So, yeah. And my husband used to use it in mabo tofu. And bok choy, including the stems, of course. And then hit it with some parsley. It's really delicious. And I love the natto salad too. There's a few crossover dishes that were, you know, like the ketchup. There was a few dishes that have ketchup in it.
I noticed that. Yeah. I think there was like a shrimp fried rice dish.
Yeah, and I was thinking, I should maybe freshen that up and use some sort of tomato sauce. And then I thought, no, I don't think I should. And so I used Muir Glen tomato ketchup. I wouldn't use homemade. But this is a natto salad where you have a iceberg lettuce cup and cubes of apple and avocado. Okay, this is not a seasonal gist. Let's get over it. And also avocados come from Mexico. There's one person apparently in Japan we've found now.
To get avocados?
Yeah, my son found it, Andrew. And so we're waiting until they're in season. But so apple, avocado, red onion, smaller pieces of red onion, of course, and then daikon sprouts, and then Parmesan cheese.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, now, I did not go so far as the Kraft thing, but we had
the green.
The green can. That was ubiquitous, yeah. Parmigiano Reggiano is what I use. And then you blend up the Japanese mayonnaise with natto and not kewpie mayonnaise, because that's
not kewpie.
Oh my God, that's horrible stuff. We have matsuna mayonnaise. I usually make my own, but for Japanese applications, I think the Japanese style. I mean, Whole Foods is making it. There's options available. I think that the French jarred one is probably the best option, frankly. But anyway, and then you put that dressing over the salad. It's quite delicious.
It's so fascinating. There's nothing in particular about that would read to me as,
no,
you know, quote unquote Japanese.
Right, but it was a thing.
And then I suppose I would have to ask, do you have a favorite recipe from this book?
Favorite. There's 400 recipes, so.
I noticed.
Yeah. I really love the Yuba recipe. It's it has chrysanthemum greens and roasted shiitake and some enoki that have been simmered a little bit in dashi and yuzu, and it's got a lovely dressing. Yuba is the, you know, the soy milk skin that's formed as you're heating the soy milk for making tofu. So that's a great dish.
Nancy, thank you so much.
Sure. Thank you for having me.
The Bon Appetit Foodcast is produced by Carrie Polis and Christina Che, and produced and edited by Emma Wortsman. Our theme music is by Nathaniel Wortsman. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us about this or any other episode, email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.